Hello, my name's Bernadette Russell.
And my name is Gareth Briley.
Welcome to our short storytelling podcast. We hope that you're sitting with your feet up, maybe a cup of tea in your hand.
Maybe something stronger. Who are we to judge?
So today we've got two stories for you. So if you are indeed sitting comfortably,
then we'll begin. The allotment. "Morning, Derek," Joan said, walking up to Derek's vegetable patch where he was pruning away at some carrot tops.
"Oh, hello, Joan. Nice day today, isn't it?" Derek said, standing up with a little bit of a groan and a sigh.
"It's not too shabby, is it, Derek?" she said, looking up at the sky.
"I think it'll rain later, though."
Joan pulled a face as she said this.
"Could do with it." "I think you're right, Joan. Can't have too much sunshine, can we?"
he said with a chuckle. Joan joined in and they both fell into silence.
"You're not wrong, Derek, you're not wrong."
She surveyed the allotment and noticed three other elderly gardeners at work on their patches. Also, near her right, there was a woman in her mid-30s wearing blue dungarees and a red scarf around her head, on her knees planting seeds. Joan's eye fell on her.
"How long has Madam been here?"
Joan said, her voice suddenly turning hard.
"Well, she was here well before me when I arrived around 7,
Derek said.
"What's she growing?"
said Joan, still watching her carefully.
"Japanese mugwort," said Derek, eyebrows raised.
Joan quickly turned to him, mouth open in alarm.
"Japanese mugwort," she said, outraged.
"I told her." Derek shook his head in dismay. "You can't grow Japanese mugwort in Bermondsey." Joan was flabbergasted.
"I told her,"
repeated Derek, still shaking his head. "Oh, she's a strange fish, that one. Coming in here with her fancy ideas how to grow. How long have we been here, Derek?" Joan asked.
34 years,
Derek said on cue. 34 years. And Madam thinks she can teach us a thing or two about growing. Joan had picked up a shovel by now.
"What was that rubbish she was spouting at the last meeting?"
"Biodynamic methods," answered Derek.
"What tosh! What does she think we've been doing here? Knitting for the last 30 years?
Offered Joan, pointing the shovel over to her.
"I know,"
said Derek.
"I rue the day we ever let her in those gates," Joan carried on.
"I know," repeated Derek. Joan was now digging furiously.
"I said, though, didn't I? I said no to the application because she wasn't one of us, didn't I, Derek? I knew it would be trouble from the moment I laid eyes on them, madam."
At that moment, the woman who they'd been talking about sees them and waves over. Immediately, Derek and Joan smile while waving back.
"Friendly, though," said Derek.
Yeah, I'll give her that," replied Joan. She let out a big breath to signify the end of that topic. Derek noticed the change and picked up his flask.
"Nice cup of tea, Joan,"
he offered. "That'd be lovely, Derek," said Joan. Derek smiled and unscrewed the flask and poured Joan a steaming cup of milky tea. Joan blew on the tea and then took a sip.
"Oh,
that's just what the doctor ordered," she commented, still drinking.
"How's that granddaughter of yours?" asked Derek.
"Oh, she's grand. Graduating next week," she said proudly.
"No, that went quick,"
said Derek. 7 years, Derek. Goes by, doesn't it?" said Joan, pouring the dregs of the tea onto the ground.
"So she's a doctor, officially, like," said Derek with enthusiasm.
"Oh, yes. She starts at a GP practice in Hemel Hempstead next month," Joan said boastfully.
"My word! Hemel Hempstead! Who would have thought it? You must be over the moon,"
Derek cooed. "I'm pleased for her, Derek. She's worked hard and it's paying off for her now. She's like me, you know. Got my genes in her.
Not like the other side of the family,"
Joan said, giving Derek a knowing look.
"Hemel Hempstead, well, I never,"
said Derek, lost in the moment. Joan looked at her watch and lightly clapped her hands together.
"Right, tea break's over, Derek. You ready?" she said.
"Always ready, Joan,"
Derek smiled, and they both walked away from the plot towards one of the sheds at the end of a row. As they got closer, Joan spots, tied on a tether by one of the sheds, a goat who's eaten a pile of carrot tops on the floor.
"You got him, then?"
she said, watching the goat warily.
Yeah. I got him off Bob's mate, you know, the Middle Eastern fella. Derek scratched his head. Tom, that's it. Apparently, he has more goats than he knows what to do with.
Derek laughed as he said this. Joan laughed as well and pointed at the goat who was still eating the carrot tops. He looks healthy, she commented.
Yeah, likes his food as well, said Derek.
We'll bring him in the shed and then we can make a start, said Joan, heading towards the shed. At the door, she made a strange, complicated gesture with her hands, opened the door and went in.
Rightio,
said Derek, and untied the leash holding the goat and coaxed him inside the shed. Inside, the shed was dimly lit by candlelight. Candles of all shapes and sizes were placed in and around the space. In the centre of the floor was an upside-down pentagram chalked into the wooden slats. Candles were placed all around the outline of the pentagram, burning brightly. Joan stood at the back of the shed, naked, holding a black hooded robe.
Come on, Derek, I haven't got all day, she said, annoyed. She then threw another black robe across the room towards Derek, who caught it in one hand.
Derek then took all his clothes off in one motion, leaving him naked as well.
Bit chilly, isn't it?
Said Derek, putting the robe over his head and letting it cover his naked form. Joan did the same, and the goat knocked a few candles over. She then picked up an old black leather-bound book from the workbench and opened it up.
You ready?
She said to Derek. Derek nodded cheerfully and stepped inside the pentagram, grabbing the goat by its collar, pulling him in as well. Joan watched him, then stepped in the pentagram as well. It was a bit crowded. She started to read slowly from the book.
Oh, Master, we call to you on this special of special days. Our love for you is denser than a forest. Our love for you is pure as snow. Our love burns in our hearts. We are your humble servants. We are your puppets to do as you will.
She cleared her throat.
Oh, Master, we want your permission to summon one of your own. Oh, Master, we want to summon Bacca the Biter.
Derek then chanted a name three times. Joan waited until he finished and then continued. Then they both chanted together as one.
Oh, Master, we are selfless servants. We are yours to command. We do your bidding here on earth. We are faithful. Please accept our simple sacrifice.
Joan put the book back on the workbench and nodded at Derek. Derek, with his left hand, drew out a long, ancient knife from his robe and slit the goat's throat. There was a couple of bleats and the goat staggered, then fell onto the ground. Blood poured from the dead goat's neck, across the floor and up to the edges of the pentagram, where there it began to make a slow, fizzing sound. The candles grew brighter as the blood boiled, and in the centre of the pentagram, smoke started to appear. In the smoke, if you really squinted, you could see a figure of a being with a human body and what seemed to be a huge crocodile head. But then, with the smoke, it quickly disappeared. The blood stopped boiling, and the candles dimmed.
Oh, no, exclaimed Joan loudly.
What happened?
Said Derek, still holding the bloody knife. Not strong enough, said Joan.
Oh, that's a shame, said Derek.
I thought it was all going rather well, said Joan.
You read very beautifully, Joan,
said Derek with a smile.
Thank you, Derek,
Joan replied.
Do you think we needed to have anal sex in the blood of the goat?
Asked Derek. I don't think it would have done any good, if I'm honest, Derek, she said sadly.
Rightio,
said Derek, and put the knife away. Joan picked the book up again, examining it carefully, and after a few moments, she slammed it shut with a wallop.
We need a more powerful sacrifice, Derek, it says here, said Joan. Oh, I could ring that Tom up for some more goats, he suggested brightly.
I don't think any more goats are going to cut the mustard, Derek.
She went over to the workbench and thought for a moment, then broke out into a big smile.
Why don't you invite Madam out there to come in for a nice cup of tea? Say we want to, oh, I don't know, need her expert advice on how to grow Japanese mugwort.
Derek looked at her, and then the penny dropped.
Rightio,
I'm going to need a bigger knife, he said, taking off his robe to put his normal clothes back on again. The candles in the shed began to swell brighter as Joan quickly mopped away the blood of the last sacrifice.
The Hangman Meets Death. 1852. This new year leapt into being, one of those every 4 years blessed or cursed with an extra day. It's said that this stolen day allows a gateway for things that only usually exist in our imaginations, and that they take their chance to bound into being. But it's a folktale told by poor country farmers, and no one believes that anymore. The year started on a Thursday, and into this world popped James Berry. His mother's midwife, Connie Brack, smiled as she lifted his sticky red head. Thursday's child has far to go. As baby James took his first lungful, he cried and coughed almost simultaneously, for the London air of the 1850s was full of muck, and Connie thought to herself, as she often did, why do the newborns scream so? Is it because they don't want to leave the cosy, warm, pink-lit cave in which they've been ensconced, or because they know what's coming? She can be forgiven for this morbid thought, as more often than not these children of the poor didn't live much past their fifth birthdays, and when they did, their lives were miserable and hard. But not so for James Berry. Clever, ambitious, impulsive and romantic, James spent his early years in the police force, arresting the hungry for pinching bread, splitting up fights caused by too much ale and not enough hope, chucking girls in cells for satisfying the colourful desires of men who look just like their fathers. After hours, he'd go and have a drink with William Marwood, cobbler and part-time executioner, and they'd spend their nights discussing the merits of hanging the true guilty, not those for whom crime is the only option. When Marwood died, Berry applied for his job, stating, I'm no sadist nor a madman, and I have a method quick and painless. He would be paid handsomely for the grisly task, £10 a time when a loaf of bread was only a penny, and he secured the position and waited for the order. So far, so simple. But this was a leap year. 131 hangings later, Berry had done his job, but in the pursuit of improvements in the standards of his craft, he had been investigating the refinement of the long drop, intended to diminish mental and physical suffering. There'd been some errors with this experimental method. Too long a drop meant the rope had decapitated poor Robert Goodale, and barely a month later had not had any effect at all upon murderer John Conway, save bruising his neck and ruining his singing voice. Berry spent the next 48 hours alone, with only himself for company and a bottle of scotch. He was fretting over his new method and spent his time practising with bags of cement, gallows and trapdoors, like a grisly magician. 2 days and two nights without sleep, practising how to kill. What made him different from the various thugs who gulleted girls in rancid East End alleyways was only a salary and the letter of the law. By midnight on the second evening, he was half mad from lack of sleep and a diet of chewing tobacco and whiskey. Hello, James.
I said no one to come in. The rent's by the door. Get out.
I thought I could help. I'm something of an expert. James looked up to see a grey-eyed man, beautifully dressed, carrying a silver cane.
Who?
He began, but he didn't finish the question as he knew exactly to whom he was speaking.
You're...
Yes, I am. Death, whom you usually only see once and then with some relief, had slipped through the cracks of the 29th day of February 1852, aided by Berry's semi-hallucinogenic state, and paid the executioner a visit. Death to death, as it were. "Let's clear a few things up," said Death. "I'm not the devil, and I'm not interested in the petty arguments of competitive gods. I'm not evil. Like yourself, Mr. Berry, I'm just doing my job. I have no concern with guilt or innocence. It's none of my business. I cannot be moved to either compassion or cruelty. You are the Riverman, bringing people over from one shore to the other, and until these times change, as they surely will, I'll help you do it well." "Thank you," said Berry. "However," continued Death, "everybody has their time, Mr. Berry. I'm sure you're aware of that, a time to live and a time to die. And you will find if you try to take people before their time, they won't go. Or rather, I won't take them. There has to be order. Everyone, even the lowest amongst us, has a job to do, in case you're wondering why we're here. I need to show you something. Your streets are stalked by something that has no place here, travelled up to take away the last shred of hope from the poor, and he's a cheat and a liar, two things I simply can't abide. He thinks he can't be caught, as he lives in our minds as well as in our streets, and he'll pop up again, no doubt, in distant times, whenever there's a 29th in the second month. But you are here, sent now, to see to him, and because of him, or despite of him, when he's gone, things here will get better. Come with me," said Death, and he tucked poor old James Berry under his insubstantial arm and lifted him upwards like a malevolent Peter Pan. To James, it just seemed like he had fallen to sleep, lullabied by the gentle voice of Death. "It's just a short journey, Mr. Berry." And they flew away, above the stinking turd-filled Thames, fizzing with swollen bodies and sacks full of unwanted kittens. They travelled, by the light of the full moon, circled with smog, to the music of baying mutts and fighting toughs from the riverside taverns. Down Hangman's Alley they flew, where the bats were shrinking and the cats were stinking and the rats were shivering in the sewers, where the spiders crawled up prostitutes' alleyways. Past a guttering candle in a hovel, lighting up the unwashed faces of newly orphaned children, past little Annie the flower girl, her flaxen curls and rosy cheeks disguising a life harder than we will ever know. "Poor Annie," said Death. "It's nearly time for her to go. Poor Annie, bent horribly out of shape before she was even out of nappies. From her Jack Frost-bitten fingers she drops her last posy of violets. Down, 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 it falls into the gutters, alive with rats squealing, and it seemed to Mr. Berry that they fell too, following the violets as they drifted downstream. Past Mr. Mavis the butcher, wiping blood-stained hands on his stripy apron, another day over, preparing tripe and sawdust pies for the poor. Away, away, towards the glittering lamplight of Piccadilly. Mr. Berry could see the ladies in their velvet capes and powdered gloves spilling out of chandelier theatres on the arms of buttered-up gentlemen with their handlebar moustaches and leather riding boots. Past Charlie and his pram full of chestnuts, past the hawkers, the stalkers, the mawkers and the match-sellers, up to Oxford Street, full of shop windows with silk umbrellas, they flew over Bloomsbury Square, Lincoln's Inn Fields, over the stink of Spitalfields, down to Buck's Row, Whitechapel, where girls dressed as boys and boys dressed as girls sell their innocence for a dull silver penny. "Look down, Mr. Berry," said Death. And Mr. Berry obeyed, no longer sure whether he was awake or asleep. "Look. The light is on, and the lamps are lit in old Tom's gin palace." And they slowly drifted onto the cobbles. Mr. Berry pressed his chapped nose up against the bevelled, soot-grimed windows and saw the oil lamps are lit and sitting at the table with a pile of steaming eels and a finger of gin, three girls, Nellie Dean, Lizzie Pope and little Mo. "I'll be back for them before their 25th birthdays, but not tonight, for they still know how to enjoy themselves," smiled Death. "Come, come,
Come and make eyes at me down at the old bullen bush. La, 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 la. Come, come, drink some port wine with me down at the old bullen bush.
There they go, giggling out past closing time with sailors on their arms, back to flea-bitten lodging rooms for the promise of love and the certainty of disappointment. All except poor Lizzie, afflicted from birth by a syphilitic mother. Buck-toothed, hair-lipped, cross-eyed, she begins the long journey home alone. Lizzie decides on a shortcut, for the night is cold. What's that? The flare of sodium, the strike of a match against cobbles. Who is behind? There's been talk amongst the girls, whispered Death, of a handsome stranger who fillets and guts the girls like so many kippers and leaves them trussed and dead in the mouldering leaves. We're here to stop him. He'll be found, protested Mr. Berry. The police will find him. It's not my job to. But he's after their wombs. He doesn't want anyone else to be born. He's after the end of you all, Mr. Berry, and that I can't tolerate. It's not right, said Death. He should leave you to fight amongst yourselves. What's that? The strike of blade against blade, of sharpening knives, the swirl of fog and the swish of a cape. Lizzie walks faster, breaking into a trot, bare feet slapping against flagstones, panting fiercely. And who's this coming up behind her, eyes like coals in the dimly lit passage, hot breath against her pockmarked skin, manicured nails digging into soft flesh, glint of steel, flash of blood. As the murderer glanced up, he saw Death and the hangman watching him, and he recognised them both, and they saw him. Mr. Berry felt a sudden chill, and Annie took her chance to scarp her with nothing worse than a scratch on her belly, although she'd never be the same again, poor thing. You see, Mr. Berry, said Death, just as the girls have been saying, he doesn't belong here. And James had to agree as he fought against himself not to run. The murderer stood frozen, his fingers sticky with entrails and mucus. Go home, said Death. I'm sure you're missed. 2 months later, James Berry performed the long drop, perfected at last, on the body of one William Worth, convicted wife murderer. It was said, but never proven, that he may have been Jack the Ripper, and true to tell, the murders stopped after that. Berry never recovered from his ordeal, although he understood his nightmare to be a result of alcohol and sleeplessness. He drank now in earnest and preached where he could on the terrible weight carried by the hangman, and he pleaded for the abolition of capital punishment. 5 years later, when his sands had run out, and he lay hot and stinking in a makeshift cot in Houndsditch, his last dying words, overheard by his priest, were, "There you are. I wondered when I'd see you again."
Thank you very much for listening.
And I hope you enjoyed it. Now, if you did enjoy it, please like, subscribe, comment on any of the formats you're listening on. And if you really, really liked it, we set up a Patreon for £3 a month. The description of it and the link is in the podcast description. And if you click on that, you would get your name in the credits and also maybe some extra little hidden features that we might add.
And our undying gratitude.
Of course.
And we would love to thank our existing Patreon angels, who are Ella Crease.
Ella, thank you so much.
Emma Waterford.
Emma, you are brilliant.
Ian Payton.
Ian, you're a star from heaven.
Jane Carey.
Jane. Jovial Jane, you're...
He's lost for words. Katie Young.
Katie, I love you with all my heart.
Natalie Russell.
Natalie, wow.
And last but not least, the incredible, the inimitable Deborah McGee.
Deborah McGee, you are a magical, heaven-sent dream in my pocket.
Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Sweet dreams.